Hello and welcome to Vassals of Kingsgrave. My name is Kevin, and today we'll be discussing Witcher, The Blood of Elves, the first four chapters. I am joined today by...
Hello, this is Bing. I'm Shushan on the forums.
And I'm David, David HHH on the forums.
Hey, this is Adam, Drown Snow.
Hi, this is Abby, Daisy Mormont.
This is Zach, alias in the forums. Happy to be joining the Witcher podcast.
Yay, welcome, Zach.
Thank you. We're happy to have you. We've got a couple new faces this time, and a couple of people that have been on the first few couldn't make it today, so I have some different opinions. They might all be the same. Who knows?
Ooh, different opinions.
We all know the first rule of Witcher Book Club.
Yeah, we all know that.
We have to be neutral?
No, we can't say it on the podcast, Bing.
Yeah, I can't.
We all know it.
Jeez.
Well.
Okay.
There you go. Well, now that's ruined. Let's ruin something else.
I guess we should get started, everybody. So we'll get going here into Blood of Elves. Before we get into specific chapters, did anyone have any strong overall thoughts on this? On this first half, the first four chapters of Blood of Elves?
I liked it infinitely better than any of the short stories. So that was a plus.
How many?
Yeah.
Let's go with Roses of how do you say
Sherwood?
It?
I think it's Sherwood.
Sherwood.
Yeah, okay. Something like something like Sherwood, but with a funny accent.
Okay.
Yeah.
Do they say it in the games, maybe? Or?
I have never played them. It just looks like it should be pronounced Sherwood.
Nah.
We'll go with it. In the words of George R. R. Martin, pronounce it how you want.
Yeah. I'll give it 3.5 roses, I think, is fair. It's like a solid C. It's passable, a little better than passable. I don't really like the random POV changes halfway through the chapters. It's kind of disorganized, but compared
to... Don't worry,
to
that'll never happen again after this, I promise.
compared to the short stories, it's like, mwah, chef's kiss, like, breath of fresh air.
You didn't like the short stories?
No, I hated them. I didn't even end up finishing Sword of Destiny. I hated it so much.
And the last book, the last story was like most important for this.
I don't care. It sucks.
Okay. I feel like some of the short stories are definitely disorganized, but I did the audiobook and like the guy that reads them is so good. He just kind of keeps pulling you through. So
we've lavished some praise on the audiobook reader a couple times on prior podcasts. I think he's Witcher Vox official recommendation for the replacement for our dearly departed Roy Dotrice when the time comes.
Well, who knows when that'll be.
Yeah.
But he has to do Tyrion as a leprechaun. I mean, that's just obvious.
Okay.
Usually we get to the Winds of Winter coming out like 2 hours in, but
we jumped
3 minutes.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for just Blood of Elves in general and just kind of jumping off what Abby was just talking about, I did personally, when I was reading these the first time, like I loved Blood of Elves relative to the short stories. I just think, in general, like having the sustained momentum of a novel. And I think for me, like really the essence of what makes this whole thing good is the relationship between Ciri and Geralt. Yeah. It's the same kind of thing as like, the things people have talked about with like the Mandalorian TV show. It's like that relationship between like the stoic badass and the person mm-hmm. who needs to be protected. I think there's just like some kind of vitality and appeal and tension in that kind of thing. And it's cool. So having that, I think it improved things a lot for me. I didn't hate the short stories like Abby did, but I definitely did not enjoy them nearly as much as this kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, I like the short stories. I thought they were fine. And it's hard for me to judge this yet because it's just starting and not a lot has happened yet. But, I mean, I'm definitely enjoying the narrative. I'm enjoying actually having different POVs from Geralt. So, you know, getting to see who these other characters are and how they think. I'm liking that. I'll give it about a 3.5 only because not that much has happened yet. But, you know, a positive, like,
so
3.75 maybe.
Were we not supposed to finish the book? I don't know, because I'd already finished it before.
Yeah,
that's fine.
Just okay. Half. We're only talking about the first half.
But. Yeah. I know that. I just wasn't sure. Because, I mean, I really like this book, personally. Like, I know, like, it does feel kind of slow in the first few chapters. But,
right. But that's expected.
I like the way they're going, like, compared to the short stories. I think the short stories did a lot to kind of establish the world. And there was a lot of, like, you know, different takes on classic fairy tales. And, I kind of dug that. But overall, like, you know. I like how much we're, series story we're getting here. And there's just a lot of stuff that I think surprised me. I wasn't expecting in these books. So, yeah, I mean, I give this like a 4 out of 5.
I think I'm on the same boat as Adam. That's it. I have read all of them before and played all the games. Well, not all the games, not the first one, but so this is the part of the story.
Which sucks.
but this is the part of the, I don't think like if I just, if I'm being objective, whatever that means, I'm taking at face value, I don't think these chapters are actually that good. That said, I have a lot of nostalgic value for these chapters. These are the chapters I'd like to go back and reread the most. Partly because they're, well, not a lot happens in them, yes, but it's very peaceful. And my favorite characters are very happy in these chapters.
I was going to say, everything's still good. Shit hasn't hit the fan yet.
Yeah. So that's my perspective.
And I do think that first chapter is really good in this book.
That's true.
Yeah, I like the first one a lot, which we'll get to.
Yeah, I really enjoyed the first chapter a lot. Like, I think I read it all in one go, which was a big deal compared to me trying to read any of the short stories.
That was how I had to read.
Abby, well-known Witcher hater.
Read the short stories like all at once, like one in one go. I had to put my phone across the house, have a either Kindle or paper book, and just read an entire short story in one sitting, or I couldn't get through them.
I did do that for the podcast because like I had to finish the book, but I literally sped read that. I didn't even realize that like what's her face Pavati or whatever her name was pregnant. Like I just missed so much because I was like just like wow. I just got finished.
I think we all missed that.
Well, this chapter will be interesting without reading the short stories about that.
Yeah, I kind of felt like the short stories. I did like, especially the second half of Sword of Destiny. Like those last three stories were really good. But I felt like for the most part, reading those first two books, it was like going for a jog or something, where like you hate every minute of it, but at the end you're glad you did it. Like, because it sets up the first half of this book really well. Like coming into this book, just kind of feeling a little bit oriented in the world, like that you know where things are and sort of who some of the players are, and that you know who Nilfgaard is and Sintra and all those kind of things. I think it goes a long way. Compared to if you just picked up Blood of Elves and started reading and didn't have any concept of the happenings before that got you there. So, and I think because these first, especially the first three chapters are very character heavy without a lot of plot moving forward, that having that background in the world is kind of needed so that you understand what a lot of those interactions mean.
You'd be like, who the fuck is this bard? Like,
what? Yeah, exactly. I think if you just try to do Blood of Elves without any of the prior stories, I could very easily see people starting that and going, what in the world? This is the most boring series I've ever read, and giving up. Before I think chapter 4 really, when a lot of the action starts happening. So, but I did really enjoy these first four chapters, and started into the fifth, but I have a feeling that I will enjoy the rest of the book in the series. So I'm going to give this 4 roses of Sherwood. I don't know. I'll get it.
Cover your mouth and mumble.
So 4 roses of shh. Okay. that's everyone's roses. So unless there are kind of other overall thoughts, we'll hop into chapter one.
All right, so that's me. The chapter starts with Ciri having nightmares about her escape from the Sack of Syndra, which happened in the last short story, in the last book. Specifically, she's having a lot of nightmares. She's being afraid of this black horseman, this black knight with this weird feather helmet, who's been chasing after her. Meanwhile, Dandelion is basically broadcasting the life story of Geralt in front of a crowd underneath this this tree called the Bleoberis, which is a place where people of all races can gather and not try to kill each other. And after he did that, an asshole named Rience find him and try to shake him out of information about Ciri. Dandelion was almost tortured to death, but then he was saved when Yennefer came in and saved his ass and burned Rience's face. Yennefer and Dandelion chat, and they talk about where Geralt could actually be. Meanwhile, Geralt managed to take Ciri back to his home, Kaer Morhen, where all the witchers live, and stay during winter. There he meets his friend Esko and Lambert, as well as his teacher Vesemir, as well as another witcher who's staying with them, Cohen. That's basically it.
Yeah, but I appreciate the interaction here. I think it's not something that we've seen, like a direct one-on-one interaction between them.
Yeah.
So that was cool. And I do think it is cool to see Yennefer popping in and basically saying, like, do not tell people about Ciri, because Ciri is important and people are looking for her, a lot of people. And that again, for me, is important to point that out, because it really establishes the core tension of the story, which is that a lot of people are trying to get Ciri, so that immediately engages you as a reader on what the stakes are.
Right. Yeah, I mean, yeah. I feel like... Go ahead, Abby.
Oh, no, I was just saying, like, this chapter, like, I definitely, like, was thinking about it throughout reading the other chapters, because I just, like, kept... I mean, maybe this is more for the chapter four discussion, but, like, it doesn't seem like they're doing that much to hide Ciri, like, once they leave the Witcher place. And stuff, because she's like, hi, I'm Ciri, like, what's up? And then, like, Yennefer is all like, don't tell anyone, like, keep her on the DL, like, she doesn't exist, like, it's just was an interesting dichotomy that I noticed.
Yeah, so there's also need to take into account the time frame, the time that covers these four chapters. 3 years basically pass from chapter one to chapter four.
Oh, okay.
I think so, right? Because chapter one starts right after, basically a few months after Battle of Salton Hell and the Sack of Syndra. Mm-hmm. And then later on in chapter three, it's pointed out 2 years have then passed since then. And then in chapter four, it's mentioned series 13, this must be another year. I think that's how the timer works.
Also, I think there's a lot of evidence in these chapters that Geralt isn't the most careful person.
No.
On the planet.
And Ciri definitely isn't.
Well, Ciri doesn't understand her importance yet in the way that Yennefer does. So that might be part of it. She doesn't how important it is for her to keep secret and hidden and all that. Right. At least as far as we know.
Absolutely.
Well, one thing I thought was interesting about this chapter is that as much as we talk about how... you know, what the thing we love most is Geralt and Ciri and their relationship. I thought, at least in this chapter, like, I was really pulled in by our bard's story and Yennefer jumping in at the end there. Like, I really, you know, when I read, a lot of times I take it as like work, like, okay, I'm going to get 7 pages done tonight or, you know, whatever. And whatever I had planned for this chapter, as soon as, like, you know, as soon as Dandelion got captured and all that, I was like, oh, I like this. And I just, like, I kept going. I'm like, yeah, I can do 3 more pages. I can do 2 more pages. And next thing you know, the chapter was over. And I was like, oh, well. So I really enjoyed that part of the story, you know, even though we haven't yet seen Dandelion again, but, or Yennefer, but I liked that. And starting with them I wonder for someone who hadn't read the short stories how impactful that that part would be, since they don't know who these people are. But having read them, I enjoyed it.
So as someone who didn't read the last short story that apparently is like Sodden Hill or whatever being sacked, I felt that these chapters were like a very nice exposition dump, like kind of catching me up to speed with like what's going on and stuff. Like, obviously I knew who all the characters were, but it was like, okay, this thing happened, you know, and he was like very much like, it was not very well done execution. What is the word that I just said? Exposition. It wasn't a very like crafty exposition jump. It was like, okay, I'm gonna sing a song and then everyone's gonna fight in dialogue about like what's happening and like now I know everything. But like it was a nice introduction to be like, okay, this is everything you need to know and you're good to go. And like I thought that it was not confusing, I guess. Right.
Although you need to take into account that all the exposition is coming from imperfect narrators.
Right.
Who all have their own perspective, both Dandelion as well as all the other people chatting. And even Yennefer.
Yeah, speaking of the other people chatting, I did like all the sort of specific context we get in this chapter. And this is, of course, a theme and a thread that runs through all these chapters and through the book. But just the sort of idea of these different racial relationships that exist in this world, and particularly the point that I liked in this one was this idea that was brought up about how humans have been breeding with elves for their entire history, so there's like a ton of intermixing of that blood. I just thought that was a unique way of approaching that particular sort of fantasy relationship that doesn't typically appear in that fashion in most other material, where there's like this long history of interbreeding.
Honestly, this is also more relevant to chapter 4, and Kevin, you can feel free to cut this out if you don't want to get controversial on the cast, like no one has responded. But this book just made me think, maybe just because I've been talking about this with a lot of people recently, but it just made me think of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict a lot. In regards to like, oh, like the humans have been here for this long, but the elves have been here for this long, but before the elves were these people. And I was just like, like the entire time I'm reading, I'm like, this is like the Israeli-Palestinian conflict.
You can pick a conflict, honestly.
Yeah, I would say there are lots of them around the world that I'm sure he's picking, you know, he's using.
I mean,
people want land that other people have. Yeah. Right.
It's kind of all of human history.
Native Americans versus European settlers. I mean, that's even, you know, even more striking because the idea of humans coming from across the ocean.
Yeah. Well, no, but like what I was saying is like, because like in chapter 4, the dwarf, whatever his name is, he was like, well, like first the elves, he was like, first the elves were here, but he was like, but actually the elves were only here for like 2,000 years. So actually there were people here before them. Yeah. So it's just like, that's what I was like, made me think of that. But,
I feel like this chapter as well as chapter 4 really sort of, and even chapter 3 a little bit, set sort of the racial tension up a lot compared to the short stories, which I mean, there was of course there during the what's the grain, the price of grain or whatever short story, the Phil of Andrew one, but here you really see like after the Nilfgaard, the first Nilfgaard war, racial tension between, I mean, human non-human tension really amped up.
And I believe it's in this chapter we get a mention of part of Nilfgaard's goal is to make everyone equal. I think that's this chapter. Yeah, so that is kind of an interesting nuance to what their objectives are. Like, we kind of see on a surface level Nilfgaard is the big bad enemy, but they have
anti-communism.
But they have some objectives that might be more altruistic or just better for the common good of people than the people that we're supporting or the nations that we're like naturally on the side of.
Right. And I think that's a nice twist for a fantasy series, because, you know, so often you get the like, you know, the evil Mordor coming to kill everyone and they're all bad just because they're bad. But here we actually have, you know, what really happens in life where, you know, the other side isn't bad. They just are looking for something different. And maybe that isn't always the worst thing.
And it's interesting. And also he's writing from an Eastern Bloc country. Like, I don't remember.
True.
So, you know, we got that anti-communism message.
Well, again, but again, the idea is
we start with the perspective of Ciri, of Nilfgaard doing all these horrible things, of her very internal fear of Nilfgaard rape and pillaging a city. But then immediately afterwards, we get the vantage point of non-human saying, Nilfgaard ain't that bad.
You know, I think it's hard to separate. You know, once you know that Andrzej Sapkowski is from Poland, and that he lived under the Soviet Union, it's hard not to look for that to an extent. But my thing when I read this is I keep seeing critiques of every system of government in certain ways. Like, I don't think he is, maybe he more or less just seems skeptical about, or maybe even cynical about people in power in general. And seems like he's maybe just more of a deconstructionist in a way. Like, I think, Zach mentioned elves and humans breeding. You know, I hadn't really thought about that in the context of other fantasy, but that really isn't a thing for the most part in other fantasy. Like, usually they like to have some sort of elder race and, you know, may have a few different races that inhabit a planet, but there's rarely interbreeding.
It's like a shock if someone crosses.
Right. Like a half elf is a rare thing, and whenever that sort of concept appears, but here, and this might not be true because, like Bing says, there's some unreliability to the people who are talking, but the implication is that like every human has elf blood to some extent because of at some point in their history that there was some kind of intermixing that happened.
Any other thoughts on our first chapter here and poor Dandelion and his
things that really changes once you get into the novel format is that these characters' names now matter. Whereas in the short stories, there's a bunch of very disposable characters that only show up in one story and then you can just completely forget about them. They don't matter for the rest of the plot. But here it's really the names now matter. This is when like Sapkowski is going to plant a name several chapters ahead and then bring them up much later. So you'll see a lot of these characters reoccur.
Doesn't mean I'm going to remember them.
Yeah.
it's a very interesting contrast. Now that we're moving into.
I know what you're talking about, Bing.
our poor like English reading brains just struggle to separate names that have lots of Y's and Z's and X's.
It is true.
Well, no, some of these are brutal.
Yeah, some of these are brutal. Although, I mean, the thing is, he already did this once. Because Atrist Marigold was actually first mentioned in the short story before that. Although, the way she's mentioned, you wouldn't expect her to come back.
Yeah.
Yeah, that.
I was a little confused at first. I was like, what?
The only reason I wasn't confused was I remember being saying to remember her name. Right. Someone asked if any of the 14, if we'd ever hear anything about him ever again. Right. Bing said, just remember the name Triss Marigold, which
I also mentioned Linty Ned or Coral, and she's really dead. So
extra
RIP. Chapter 2, it is. I believe that's David.
It is. So chapter 2 is actually from the point of view of sorceress Triss Marigold, who we'd previously heard was killed at the Battle of Sodden, driving back Nilfgaardian forces. Triss arrives at Kaer Morhen, is that how we're pronouncing that? Witcher's base and training grounds, and is greeted by Ciri, who she'd been summoned by old Witcher Vesemir to help with because of the girl's occasional strange behavior. Triss tells Ciri some background world building about how there was a bloody battle a long time ago at Kaer Morhen, where almost all of the Witchers died from a hate crime attack of fanatics spurred on by some anonymous wizard. I don't know if that's going to be important later, but it might be, which is why I brought it up. Ciri seemingly gets taken over by a magical evil voice warning Triss that if she doesn't return this child of blood where she belongs, Triss will die once more. When Geralt greets Triss, we find out that Triss has had an affair with him between the on and offs of his relationship with Yennefer, and she clearly still has a flame for him, which isn't really returned because Geralt is still stuck on Yennefer. We meet other witchers, old Vesemir, Cohn, Eskel, Lambert, although I'm not sure if which of these will be important in the rest of the series other than Vesemir, who seems like the big one. Ciri is being trained to defend herself in many of the skills and arts of the Witcher, but they're not giving her all of the mutagenic drugs and potions that perform them, although they're giving her some, because they don't know the magic needed to do it, which might be why Triss is there. While Triss is making some actual girl's clothes for Ciri, she sees many bruises all over her body from the training, and Ciri confides in her that she started having her period. Triss storms at Geralt that these men don't understand that Ciri isn't a boy, and she should be treated more carefully, and she should ease up on the secret mushrooms and greens that apparently affect girls differently from the men who they've only been used on before because of her different hormones and body parts. Triss tells Geralt and Vesemir that Ciri is a source with mediumistic powers, which worries her deeply, and then she decides to stay and oversee Ciri's training and growing up and to keep an eye out for magical stuff.
This chapter felt so much like a rom-com that like starts with a single dad.
Five single dads.
Yeah.
Yeah, right.
I guess four single dads and a grandpa.
So, which reminds me, are any of these witchers, or do we ever hear anything about the son from the end of Something More? Or did he actually go become a witcher? Do we ever hear anything about that?
No. It was originally planned that the son of the merchant would become a witcher, but then that got replaced by the actual Ciri.
Right.
Oh, that's right. That's right.
Yeah.
Plus, ran out.
Plus, Triss mentions that, like, no boy has trained here in years, so.
Yeah.
Yep. You know, go ahead.
I was going to say, I think with what you just said, I think you get the sense here that the idea of being, and this is kind of brought up in the short stories a bit as well, but the idea of being a witcher is kind of dying out. It's not a profession or just a thing that has the same level of respect or just interest that it once did. So you get that sense that, which I always like in stories, that sense that this is the last of something.
Yeah.
That actually made me think of a lot the idea of, you know, the Night's Watch in Song of Ice and Fire, in that, you know, they were once great and now they're not, and they're having trouble bringing in new people to do it and all that. It gave me that same kind of vibe.
Or it's much worse than that. Like, the youngest, I think, among all of them is either Cohen or Lambert, right? And Lambert's several hundred years old. Several hundred years old. Yeah. At Witcher ages. Lived for a very long time already.
Yeah, they're a dying breed. And Triss also mentions that, like, you know, that apparently they're not even sure they can make any more, because apparently these potions and whatever needed to be done by magic, and they've forgotten how to do it. In fact, that's why she suspects they've brought her here to, like, help with that. So they may not even be able to make more witchers, at least from what we see so far.
Yeah, which is unfortunate. It seems like there is a need for them.
I thought it was implied in the short stories, or maybe this was like a trick implication. I don't know, like a fake seed, but like that the beasts and stuff that the witchers usually hunt were like dying out, kind of, and so like there was like less of a need in general for witchers.
In terms of the monsters, I mean, there are specific breeds that witchers hunt that are known as relics. They are sort of, they shouldn't belong in that world, and they are, of course, dying out because they've been hunted over time. But then there are other piece stuff that witches hunt, like ghouls, which are just like corpses that reanimate.
And they just breed like rabbits.
Yeah.
I see.
There's so many people get killed all the time, so there's still going to be a lot of ghouls.
I see. Okay. I see.
But yeah, but I like that these men recognize that they suck as dads, and they're humble enough to go and actually find someone else who's more competent than they are at raising a girl.
Oh, I also have a question, kind of on the topic of, like, do they even know how to, like, make witchers anymore? Because, like, one of the witchers, I forget, it was either Cohen or Lambert, Bird or whatever the frick his name was, one of them is like fucked up a little bit. Like Triss says, it looks like the mutation didn't go right. So like, is he kind of like an example of like they don't really know what the fuck they're doing anymore and they kind of goofed it a bit?
I think you're talking about Cohen, and so there are different theories about that. But I think it's likely that he basically got that condition before he became a Witcher, or it's likely that he became a Witcher at a much later point of his life.
I see.
Yeah. Because, okay. Like, fucking up the procedure just means he dies.
Well, no, I don't know. She was like, it looked like the mutation had gone bad or something, so I was like, oh, is this, like, evidence that, like, they don't know what the fuck they're doing anymore, and...
This is kind of a question, but I want to point out, I think that, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Bing, but with the Trial of the Grasses that kind of makes you into a Witcher, it's not even just fucking up the mutation. You could just die regardless if you did it perfectly. Like most people aren't able to actually become a Witcher. Most people just die in the process, right?
Yeah, even when they had the perfect technology of how to do this, still like something like 8 or 9 out of 10 die.
Yeah.
From the process.
Not good. Ratio there.
No. But supposedly after undergoing the process, you should be immune to many of the diseases that have marks on Cohen that suggest that they're just normal diseases that came before the time he was a Witcher.
Okay. I did want to say on chapter 2, I really enjoyed just spending some time with Triss. I think her as the POV was just fantastic. Like there's just another level of depth and empathy to her, and props to Sapkowski for, I think, writing I don't know if she's the first female point of view, but definitely one that was memorable and very well done. I really did love the way she walked in and just she could sense the emotional gap and the sort of the lack of understanding between the Witchers and Ciri, and just immediately filled that. Like there was no, like, she didn't have to think. She didn't. It was just very clear. She had an ability to do sort of the emotional heavy lifting in that moment that none of them could do. And I thought that was very, very well done. Very cool.
Oh, and I thought one of the interesting things also is having a woman come in and tell these men, you know, hey, you know that she's different, right? She isn't just a different boy, you know? And I thought that was good coming from, you know, a male writer to bring that point of view in to, you know, like, you know, she has these breasts, right?
Yeah, I did love the part where, you know, I mean, it's just like the realization of the guys when they're like, she's got issues, and every now and then you're going to have to let her deal with them, and they're like, oh crap,
exactly. I love that bit.
Yeah, I did find it funny though how they still like won't talk about like menstruation. They're like, oh, we know all of this science, but like she's has the
that's icky.
You know, they're
like, look at the entrails of this ghoul, but
yeah, they're like, they're like, oh, I can feel the lactic acid in my muscles, you know, like whatever. But oh, she has that women thing, you know, that we're not going to talk about.
Well, I think it's funny.
I think
it's especially good that all of them were like, well, okay, we're on board with this. It's, you know, let's you need to do.
They're like, you know this better than us. We're stepping down. You're the expert.
Because, you know, you would expect men in that time or in the setting, I guess, that's the culture. You'd expect a lot of them to be like, well, that doesn't matter, you know?
Right. Well, clearly they thought that before she showed up, so...
Well,
I think they just hadn't crossed their mind. Yeah, it's not like something you would think about.
I think the fact that they sought her out in the first place, and specifically her, they know people.
Although he does, Vesemir she confronts him and says, "Wait, you brought me here to deal with this magical stuff," and he says, "Yes, only that." So he does actually say that. He doesn't say it's because of girl stuff. He says it's because of the magic. Although maybe it is.
Well, I think maybe Geralt. maybe he extended the invitation with great, you know, more purposes than just the magic stuff. But I would say the Witcher.
Maybe Geralt like said, "Okay, I'll pick this Witcher. I mean, this sorceress to be the one we contact because she's a woman."
Exactly.
Well, there's also the added spice, I guess, of Triss and Geralt's past relationship, which
also
I
specifically guess, he did not want to have Yennefer come because he's scared of that.
Yeah, and well, that sort of brings up sort of the eternal debate among the Witcher fandom. This is the beginning of the eternal struggle.
I really don't think it's a debate, though, in the context of this material. Right?
No, it's not. Yeah. But unfortunately, the Witcher fandom, the in its worst excesses, is like to spin this debate endlessly.
Get this romance out of my book, is what I have to say.
Yeah, I did. On the point of Witchers being, if they're misogynistic or not, I don't know. I kind of got the vibes that they've interacted with sorcerers enough and seen enough very powerful women from the sorcerers. Is it a guild? The group of them?
At this point, still the council.
Council. But that they've seen enough powerful women. They're not particularly harboring those prejudices. They're just kind of ignorant and have no clue what to do when it comes to...
Well, I mean, let's face it, you spent like hundreds of years being trained in a, you know, in a stronghold of just men. I mean, eventually, once you get out in the world, you'll meet more women again. But I mean, you only had whatever time you had before and later. But you know, your formative years were spent with just men. You're not going to understand very much about women. And that's fine. And I like that it's brought up and specifically, you know, talked about. And now we can move from it and learn from it.
We, of course, here in this chapter, get the first real hints of kind of everything that's going on with Ciri.
Right.
When she gets possessed, when she's meeting Triss. And I love this in the audiobook because he, like, gives her, like, a crazy, creepy voice. She's like, beware the fucking time. It's like, that's the way Ciri talks. Very scary.
I love that fantasy trope that, like, someone has a prophecy and they're, like, just become like a demon basically, and then they're like, oh, I don't know what happened, like going about my day, da 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 da. Yeah. Like I love it. It's so cliched, but I just think it's hilarious.
I also like that Triss, having heard that, they immediately say, oh, you need to learn the language of the prophecy that you're speaking. And teaches her elder language.
So now she'll know the evil things she said.
what it meant. And when somebody repeat it back to her, she now knows what she said.
Right. I mean, I guess if you're spouting prophecy, it's probably have a good idea to know what you're saying.
She's not conscious in those moments, right? Like she's not like recognizing what she, but someone could tell her after, I guess. I don't
know. Or even for now, maybe that will change. We don't know. Well, you guys know, but I don't.
After acknowledging the fact that Ciri is, in fact, magical, Triss makes her drink some magic seltzer water to put Ciri in a trance. Triss uses magic to follow Ciri into the trance and encounters a creepy man and scary visions. Then they all agree that Ciri should be with magic people who know how to handle this stuff so that she doesn't fall into a coma or something. So in the spring, Triss, Geralt, and Ciri will head to Melitelli's... I don't know what the fuck you say that word. Melitelli's temple. Melitelli's temple, so Yennefer can help her, and then... Now we're going to need a montage. And there's a fun montage. And then it's spring and it's time to leave. The end.
That was right.
All right.
The montage is
copyright
cool.
Music
I love
there.
That montage.
I love a montage.
There's the conversation towards the end between when Triss gets animated and angry at Geralt. And this is some sort of thing that carries on to the next chapter when she talks about the question of neutrality. That's what sort of separates Geralt from all the sorcerers and magicians in the world. That even though these are two groups of people who are in many ways very similar, that they're all people who could become very, very old, never ages at a much different rate than the rest of humanity. But what divides them is that the magicians, they ingratiate themselves with the rulers. They're in all the major courts across all these different kingdoms, whereas the Witchers, they want to have nothing to do with politics, and it's sort of also reflected in the earlier conversation, which whenever Triss talks about anything related to this king or that king, all the Witchers start rolling their eyes and stuff. Whereas whenever the Witchers start talking about Witcher things, Triss starts yawning. So that's sort of interesting contrast between these two groups of people.
Yeah, I think it's complicated, right? Because on the surface level, you can appreciate the desire to be neutral, because of course, when you ever you put yourself within any kind of political power, that will put you in their power, and they can use you to whatever end they want, or you will be supportive of whatever end they want, which typically means someone else is getting screwed. So yeah, like you can see the appeal of it on that level, but I think, and this probably is more true in the next chapter, we do kind of see the consequences of it too. Like if you hold yourself apart from everything, then you're not helping people who may need help.
Yeah.
You know? So there is some nuance to it that it's tricky, but yeah, I think the way the Witchers go about it makes sense for what they are and what they're supposed to be doing, which is very clear. Like, we kill monsters. Like, that is the extent of our mandate. We're not going to do anything more than that.
In theory. We're not your little magical army. Mm-hmm. It was enjoyable to listen to, but I don't have all that much to say about it.
I mean, like I said, this is nostalgic for me whenever I want to go back to the good old times. Right. The good old times. Lambert's an asshole.
Will we, now that she's moved out, are we going to get more of these other witchers or not? Like, obviously, I feel like we're going to see Vesemir again, but will the others appear again, or is this it for them?
They show up again here and there. Okay. I think I'm trying to remember. They're not major players.
They're not. Okay. That's what I gathered from the amount of time we spent with them and what we saw, but I just wanted to make sure. I was just curious.
They show up in the games again.
Everyone does, right?
Some people in these books never show up in the games.
Yeah.
I assume the dead ones don't, but
it'd be pretty impressive if all of them showed up in the games.
Yeah, there's a lot of characters, but yeah, there's a lot of characters in the books as well. Yeah, I mean, this chapter really is just exploring kind of the extent of what Ciri's power is and trying to figure out a plan to address that. It's really the main thrust of it.
Yeah, I mean, the next chapter is kind of where everything really starts going. At least towards
the end. I like the montage sequence when she's training, and at the end he's like, now take off your blindfold, because I was like, that's funny. So I liked that part of this chapter. That was my favorite part.
I love people doing badass stuff when they're blind. It's so cool.
But we didn't know she was. It was a nice little.
Yeah, a little trick. Bait and switch. Yeah.
I was like,
oh, my son now, that's his thing lately, where he keeps like, okay, I'm going to close my eyes, daddy. And he's like, let me know if I'm going to hit stuff. And he tries to like navigate the house. And like, he thinks he's like a ninja now. He wants to be the avatar. And like,
oh, yeah. And of course, that's,
he's being very spiritual. Yeah.
I remember I was like clocking Sapkowski in the short stories about how much dialogue he used. Like for everything, but I actually didn't mind it that much, especially with the montage stuff. Like, that was fine. It was like a little out of place in terms of like the structure, but it was whatever, you know. It was fun to read. Ciri got to learn how to put on eyeliner and not make her eyelids twitch, which I didn't know that was how you did that, but it makes sense.
See, you learned from Triss too.
Triss helped. Because none of us could teach you that. None of us five old dudes could teach you that, Abby.
Also, I learned that elves invented eyeliner. That's pretty cool.
There you go.
Wow. Yeah. You owe elves.
The original emos.
Oh, they definitely are.
And eyeliner.
For sure.
And you know the guys.
Yeah, they would. They would, of course.
All right. So, chapter 4, we get to head out on the road. So once Geralt and Triss decide it's high time to leave Kaer Morhen behind, they start out on a journey to deliver Ciri to the temple school in Elendur. They hear stories of a mercenary group of elves and dwarves attacking the roads, known as the Skoyatile. I prefer Skoyatel, but whatever. Or the squirrels. Triss gets very sick on the way, and the group finds help in the form of Yarpin Zigrin, a dwarf who once hunted a dragon with Geralt and Yennefer back in one of those stories. Now he's guarding a caravan for King Henselt of Caidwin. Ciri gallops off from the caravan to be alone for a while and away from people telling her what to do. She spots a band of Skoyatel just when Geralt finds her. On the way back to the caravan, they walk among the ruins of the Palace of Eleirin, an elf who led a last desperate battle against human invaders. Ciri takes one of the roses that still grows in the ruins for herself to remember what happened there. And then the Scoia'tael attack the caravan, even though Geralt was totally sure they wouldn't. In the chaos of the battle, Ciri is attacked by an elf and is almost killed, but the elf hesitates when she sees the white rose, giving Geralt just enough time to dispatch her. In the end, Yarpin and his company are able to hold off the squirrels, but he is furious when he realizes this attack was a trap set by King Henselt himself because he did not trust Yarpin and the other dwarves. So, yeah, we get to actually, you know, go out into the world here, which is exciting, mm-hmm. and kind of see a bigger picture of what's going on. We get to learn about the Scoia'tael, which are this group of dwarves and elves that are pissed off and they want some revenge, essentially. So they're attacking these groups, but in this case, they actually attack a group of dwarves, which we learn is more complicated than it appears to be.
Yeah. Also, okay, do we know what Triss was sick with, or is it like we find out later, or are we just what it doesn't matter? Like, what did she have?
Coronavirus.
Does it matter? Is it relevant to the plot? Or
yeah, I'm just curious.
Not really.
Yeah, I didn't know. Not really. Okay. She was just, she had a sickness so that for plot reasons.
Right. She had medieval stuff.
She had plot sickness.
There you go. So one thing that was bothering me when we talk about things that take you out of the narrative is like you have all these weird names of characters and then you've got Polly. Every time I see like the name Polly, I think of like, you know, Jersey Shore. Or I think of like, you know, Polly Califiore.
Yeah, I'm thinking of like a real made man. This is my man, Polly.
Yeah, like I was like, and the strange thing is it kind of fit the character, so I was okay yeah. with it. But it was just weird to me, like you have like, you know, all these weird Yarpin and, you know, Geralt and, you know, and then you've got Polly. Yeah. He just came in from Jersey Shore and he's like ready to use his axe.
Polly Shore, the weasel squirrel.
How dare you disrespect this man? He is dead.
I know. Yeah. That was
totally
weird.
Fits for me.
At least make fun of his brother. I forgot what his brother's name is already.
Reagan. Which is also just like a normal person name too.
Is it though?
I associate it with like Toddlers and Tiaras because there was definitely, I love that show and there's definitely been several toddlers on it named Reagan.
Okay, but those aren't normal people. Let's be honest.
We'll call the brother Cody after like Polly Califiore's brother.
Yeah. I don't know. Stuff. I was just mad that there was a character named Yarpin, and then there was another character whose name also started with a Y because Yannick. I was just like, why are you doing this to me? Like,
dang it, Andre.
All I could think about with Yannick was hockey players because those are the only. It's probably Yannick, but Canadians say Yannick, but those are the only. Yannick that I know are hockey players.
Sounds like a guy with a hockey stick. I don't know. Yeah. It sounds like quite a Dutch name or something.
The one that comes to mind first for me is Swiss, so I don't know.
Yeah. Germanic. It's Germanic sounding.
Favorite parts in this chapter is when Yarpin and Ciri compare their physical abuse and like who got it worse. Yeah. Like, well, my mom stapled me to the wall.
I like the... I think I shared in the chat when I read it when Triss is sick and kind of accidentally confesses her love, or she's not fully in her mind, but confesses her love to Geralt and Yarpin and Ciri over here. And he's like, when you get older, don't mistake someone being kind to you for thinking they're in love with you.
Yeah.
I was like, I think almost everyone on the planet has been on both sides of that, and it's a very awkward situation. Right. Just funny to hear it come from Yarpin.
Yeah, he's got some.
I mean, look,
got some...
dwarves are always my favorite characters, and
And I think just in general, this chapter really expands the world in a good way. My favorite part is definitely when Ciri and Geralt are coming back, and they go into the ruins of that palace and kind of talk about the history. I just think that, for me, that sketches out such a better picture of this world and the things that happened and the complexities of the conflicts and things like that. So yeah, and it was just really a gorgeous setting too, like this ruined palace filled with roses. Really nice.
Yeah, I like that a lot too. I felt like it sort of you know, you read fantasy stories so often, and like, I mean, Song of Ice and Fire is a good reference point where like you see the Veil and Winterfell, or not the Veil, but well, forgot the name of it.
The Eyrie.
And Winterfell and Storm's End, and like you have these castles that they're pumped up to have just tremendous value in and of themselves. It's like these things that sort of hold the culture together, and you know, you'd hate to lose any of them. And if, however that story ends, you know, if there's some price that's paid, and some of those castles are lost in saving the realm, like that will be the loss of the actual castle will be a lot, you know, will be heavy or will feel heavy emotionally when you read it. But then to kind of see the other side of that, which is like, here's this castle that everything's overgrown. You know, there's these beautiful flowers that people still come back, or elves come back and tend to. But it didn't stop life from going on, that ultimately it was just a building, you know, and sort of, I think kind of gets back to how I feel he's a bit of a deconstructionist. Sapkowski is, and just saying, you know, that buildings are always going to get knocked down.
You know, buildings are meant to be destroyed. Yeah.
Yeah. Like time is always going to ravage them. Yeah.
No, it makes me think a lot of, like, I've never been to Germany, but my dad was telling me, like, when he was in Germany, all the buildings are, like, quite new because they all got bombed, you know, and, like, all the old buildings got bombed. Right. And, like, when I was in Poland, like, the old city of, like, Krakow is so small because, like, just everything was destroyed.
Yeah.
And then
I've been there.
You got, like, Warsaw has some cool stuff, but mostly it's just, like, very, like, Soviet bloc, you know, functionalist buildings and stuff. And so... yeah, you can't have this, you can, like, your culture doesn't go away just because, like, the, like, structures or, like, pieces of your culture are gone. Like, you could still carry it with you even if you don't have the physical, like, grounding of it, which I thought was a nice little message, I guess.
Well, in this case, specifically, is the elves destroying their own buildings.
Right, that was the weird thing of it, yeah.
Well, to flee from the humans.
Right, but that's, I think, like, that's cool, right? That's
right.
Isn't that a normal thing, too? Where it's, like, not normal,
extremely,
but, like...
metal.
Well, it's, like, it's like the sow the earth in Europe,
dude. Yeah, well, yeah, isn't it, like, what the Russians did or whatever, where they, like, when Napoleon was advancing, they just, like, salted their fields and burnt everything down so they would, like, you know?
Yeah. Well, so in this case, it's... The idea is that these people... did these people die in just a few decades? We'll be back once they all just die out, right?
Yeah, we'll just take it back once they're dead. Well,
yeah, and then they were like, "Nope, we're just all going to our death now."
Yeah,
right.
I love Yarpin's political theory class he gave to Siri about who are the real power moves in the world. What actually helps you take over the world?
He shows real, like, his savviness in a lot of different ways and his perspective, and that just makes him a fun character. But yeah, like, it just, all of this stuff, it's so complicated, right? Because, like, you could very clearly think, right, like, okay, so the elves were the one that were in the right, but then there's a lot of material that suggests that they were doing fucked up shit as well. Like, it's all very there's no clear, these guys were the ones that had it right, which is, of course, the truest possible way to interpret that stuff. Right. And yeah,
which
too,
is how life is.
Exactly right. But then we, of course, like, Geralt is so certain, right? Like, they're just coming to look at the palace, right? Like, the Scoia'tael, they're just going to come. That's why they're here. But nope, they actually attack. which puts Ciri in danger. So that's a mistake on his part of having the stance of neutrality. It puts someone he's protecting at risk, that specific attitude he has. But then we learn, again, adding more complexity, and I'm not exactly sure the mechanics of this, but we learn that, like, King Henselt, the human king that was, you know, sending this caravan, is the one who caused this to happen. so
how this works,
I don't get that.
I can explain this sort of. So the idea is Henselt is sending secret aid, quotation mark, to the neighboring kingdom. And so Henselt is the king of Cadwen, and their neighboring kingdom is the king of Edirne, ruled by Demavent. So Yarpin and this the other guy, I forgot his name, he died. Paul, not Parley, part of this, but the other guy.
Wank.
Thank you.
Yes.
Thank you. Very unfortunate connotation his name has, but regardless. So they're basically leading a caravan that's supposedly filled with gold and silver. But then basically Hensel leaked the news of that this caravan's going through this land to the Scoia'tael, so the Scoia'tael will attack them so that he can test Yarpin's loyalty.
But I don't get how that tests his loyalty. I mean, they were attacked, they fought back.
Yeah,
I don't get that. If Yarpin attacks Wenk, or if Yarpin's just unwilling to attack his own kind.
Oh.
So basically what you have to know is that we've talked about this before, in which a lot of the rulers in this world, they're assholes. Well, yeah. Hensoldt is the special kind of asshole.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
The asshole of the asshole.
The worst.
He's probably the worst. Like, he doesn't show up a lot, but like whenever he shows up in any Witcher franchise of anything, he's basically like the worst of the worst.
But I still think it was an unnecessary risk on his part, but whatever.
Absolutely unnecessary, but he did it just to be an asshole.
Yeah.
It's because if he's a racist asshole.
Yeah. No. Yeah, he can't even fathom the idea that the dwarves escorting this caravan would ever actually be loyal, I think. Like, he actually is certain, I think, that they will not turn out to be loyal, so.
Yeah. And his definition of loyalty is basically, is Yarpin going to kill another dwarf?
Okay, so yeah, lots of fucked up people in this story. Very complicated. There's no clear good guess.
Well, which is why you don't want to fall into any traps with oversimplifying his political message. I think as easy as it is, because I had always heard that there was some critique of the politics of the 80s and 90s and Soviet Union and that kind of thing in these books, but almost wish I didn't know that heading in, like, because he really seems to kind of let everybody have it.
Well, you could do both.
Yeah.
You can let everyone have it, but focus a little more on what you know, which makes sense.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I think in this specific case, I think the message he's trying to talk about regarding the Scoia'tael is that these guys may think they're freedom fighters.
Right. But they're being used.
Yeah, they're being used by so many different sides. And not just by Nilfgaard, who is actually being open and honest about it, to be honest.
Right.
Yeah.
But by all these actual northern kingdoms who are just as, who are possibly even way worse than what Nilfgaard is doing.
I do want to say, I want to give a recommendation for anyone who might like want to explore more Witcher stuff. A kind of off-the-wall one that I thought was really a game in particular that was really good at kind of sketching a lot of this stuff out was the single player card game that CD Projekt, who makes all the Witcher games, made called Thronebreaker. Like, it's much more compared to the Witcher mainline games, it's much more loyal to kind of the situation of the books, and there's actually like moments that actually occur in the book. So of course there's spoilers there if you don't want that, but like for me that really helped give me a better sense of the world and the conflicts. If people are interested in that, it's a fun game too.
So that's set in the present, because the Witcher games are all set in the future of the books, right?
Well, define present.
So it's set where we are later in this story,
yeah,
sort of, and it's not canon technically, but it connects to a lot of the material that occurs later in this series of books.
Because all the other games, The Witcher 1, 2, and 3, all happen after the series of books finish, right?
I mean, it's kind of weird. Like, they're not quite connected. Like, there's stuff that happens in those that probably would never happen in the books.
Like, but time-wise, it's after.
Yeah, technically, yeah.
Okay, that's what I'm saying. So that means Thronebreaker is set before the other ones.
Yes.
Time-wise. Yeah.
And it's a little more, I think, faithful to what the books are trying to do.
Just trying to be clear.
Yeah. It's complicated. Yeah. Just like the books. Well, that's all I've got on this.
Yep. I mean, finally get some action. I mean, this chapter feels more like important than the others. Maybe it's just because the big battle, although the battle doesn't really turn out to be much in the end, but it feels like, you know, we're heading to something.
It has, yeah. It introduces you to a major political player.
Right.
In the series. Scoia'tael definitely will come back.
They remind me of Brandwill and the Wood Elves from in Mirkwood from Lord of the Rings. And I get those same vibes from them.
They're kind of like the
Legolas's dad and
yeah,
the elves there in the woods that are a lot more aggressive if you end up
down and there. Dirty. Getting
yeah,
the business kind of yeah. I see that.
Or if you played any Dragon Age games, the Dalish elves.
Any thoughts on kind of series progress to this point?
I think we have a much clearer, I mean, this is developed throughout the chapters, but we do get a much clearer sense of like Ciri's kind of rebellious streak in this. There's mm-hmm. a very clear mm-hmm. example of that, and just her not wanting to be beholden to anyone or anything in particular. I mean, I think that will be an interesting thread to follow mm-hmm. throughout the story.
Well, I mean, we're definitely just Ciri's still figuring out who she is and learning about the world around her. So we'll get developments as we go. And I mean, we seem to be getting pretty consistent development of her though. So that's good. She's learning.
Yeah, and of course,
she's picking it up.
Yeah, and of course she's a very new character, right, compared to Geralt at this point in the overall story. So just getting to know her.
Yeah. I like her. I like it. I like their relationship. I'm liking Triss. So I'm ready. Let's go. Keep going.
This is much more Ciri to come. I'll say that.
I would assume.
Dad Geralt's great.
Yeah.
I love when he pops in when she's just out in the middle of nowhere and he just shows up. I love that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I think it was Bina that said, it just feels like every Dwayne The Rock Johnson movie.
Yeah.
Like a cop. This is a trope in, you know, fantasy of the older, cynical guy training the young, you know, whether it be a man or a woman, you know, I mean, a boy or a girl, you know,
yeah, but
character.
It's very effective. It's
yeah, you know, and I like it. I like it. I mean, you know, we got even in Song of Ice and Fire with the Hound and Arya, yeah, which we got even more of in the show than in the books. But you know, it's a trope, but it's a trope that works, and the whole series is based around this trope. So at least
yeah, I'm a sucker for it. I love anything with like an adult being nice, like a tough adult being nice to a child. I'm like, oh my god. Now you're my favorite character. Like, you can do no wrong. Like, you just keep doing you. I love it.
And the world doesn't understand them, how good they really are.
Yeah, right. Only, I don't know.
And you also get like, you know, the younger character, you know, softening the hard, you know, warrior, yes, whatever.
Yeah, it's good stuff. It's prime material.
Well,
I think that's it.
All right. Thank you, everyone, for listening. This has been Vassals of Kingsgrave. Today we covered the first half of Blood of Elves. We'll be back in a few weeks to cover the second half. Thanks to all my fellow hosts, and everyone, have a great day.
This book's called Blood of Elves. That sounds cooler.
So I've read through the first chapter, I think, as of now. Really, really nice to have. It's still kind of, you still have changes in point of view that
right.
goes from one character to another. But it's nice to have a novel and not the short stories.
Completely agree. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, so I leave
we'll
you to your discussion, absolutely, and I can't wait to hear what you guys have to say once I've actually read the full chapters.
We can always throw that in like the epilogue, you know, the post, yeah, the after show.
Do that if it's not, it's never hard, but you can also want to just edit quickly, and that's fine too. But just wanted to mention that. Have fun discussing this, and
have a good evening.
Have a great birthday.
Yes, thank you very much. I'll see you soon. And for James and Michal, I'm not sure James listens to this, but Michal will. Happy birthday. Okay, have a nice one, guys. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye, Marie.
Bye.
This book's called Blood of Elves. That sounds cooler.
You guys should feel honored because my other book club was also meeting today, but I didn't read the book so that I could read this book. So,
what book did you not read?
I think the book we're doing this week is called Never Let You Go. Never Let Me Go. I don't know.
Doesn't sound as interesting.
That's New York Times bestseller type stuff right there.
Yeah. I picked the book last week.
Is this Oprah's book club?
No, this is my high school friend book club that we do every summer. I felt bad though because I picked the book last week and it was about AIDS in Ireland and it was just really depressing, like nonstop depressing. And so, you know.
Nice.
This book's called Blood of Elves. That sounds cooler.
much cooler, right?
Definitely not sad. All right.
This book's called Blood of Elves. That sounds cooler.
One thing I thought was a little weird, and I don't know how much of this is translation and how much of this is not, but every now and then some stuff in this book take me out of that world and make me think of like they shouldn't know this. And particularly when Triss is talking of like hormones and she talks about like adipose tissue and stuff like that, I'm like, is this something that someone in, you know, I mean, I guess the equivalent of medieval times would even know? I mean, maybe hormones would be something. I don't even know if they would know that, but they must figure there's something that causes girls to be different than boys. But I mean, I felt
the lactic acid really got me. I was like, I really learned about lactic acid in biology. Yeah. Like, what?
Right. I mean, like, that whole discussion. We have to assume that, like, even though it's like medieval times looking to us, like they have magic and science that maybe gives them a bit more knowledge than what we would expect. Like, it's a different world. So I'm okay if that's like a common thing.
Yeah, she's a sorceress. Maybe she knows.
She's been alive for how long?
Right. It did take me out of like, you know, the world a little bit. Like, wait a minute.
No, I remember that from the short stories too. And I do think it is like a translation issue because there was some other line that I noticed that like, it didn't really make like literary sense. Like it was like a bad line. And I was like, oh, it's definitely like in the translation, like it's just because these two words in English are like basically the same. It was like maybe later in the book, but I was like, it's definitely like a lot of it, I think, is a translation issue where like we don't have the words in English. But also, I do like the person who translated this much better than the person who translated Sword of Destiny, because this is the one who translated the first book, which I forget what it's called right now, or The Last Wish.
Last Wish.
And I think that they. Yeah, I think that they are much better than the person who translated Sword of Destiny. Just so you know, that's my thoughts.
Yes, and in general, I find that I'm wondering how much is translation is because there's like a lot of words that they probably used in old days that we don't use today. So like as I'm reading through, there are all these random words that I'm like, oh, I got to go look this one up. What's he saying here? And actually, in the first two books, I generally just guessed at what they meant and moved on. But on this, even in this one, there were a few that I had to like. Like I actually added like a dictionary app to my e-reader so I could click on and go, okay, what the fuck is this? And I think a lot of those are words that like are the proper translation, but aren't words that we would use today. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I've been working on a lot of translation stuff this summer, just like for fun. Like I really like to translate French to English, like short stories and stuff. And so I've definitely like gotten a greater appreciation for the art of translation, but I think that, they probably could have done better, but like probably when these books were translated, they didn't have the widespread reach that they like thought they would. So they couldn't like afford.
Interesting.
Like the best.
And so like, I'm sure like eventually they'll re-release these books, like with a newer translation. Like there's like, you know, it's like Les Miserables. Like I have a favorite translation of Les Miserables. Like there's so many and like some are better than others.
Such
and
a
I'm sure like,
nerd.
But like,
so this is, like, I'm sure we're all glad you're here then, because this is a question that I was going to have. Given the native language, and I guess it goes the same way with, you know, books written in English going all over the world, and sometimes things get lost in translation. But we don't have as much experience with that. I don't read a ton of foreign language written novels, so I was curious as to like how. About how good this was or how many things may have been kind of lost here. Cause there are definitely passages where I'm like, that just seems kind of clunky and perhaps, you know, English just doesn't have words to describe things. I know that sometimes.
Right.
Yeah, I'm sure, like, if the series, because especially it's getting so big again in, like, and obviously, like, it's always been big in the, like, English-speaking world because of the video games and stuff, but I'm sure if you give this book series, like, 20 or 30 years, they'll re-release a new translation. Like, I know that's a long time from now, but I think, I can't remember when these books came out in English, like, 2008 or something, but, like, I imagine that they weren't sure how well they were going to do, so they just didn't want to put the money into
it. I wonder if a publisher would actually spend the money, though. I mean, it's already a bestseller. Millions of people have read it. They already, I mean, it's doing well as it is, so why spend the money to do it if you don't have to? Like, I don't
know. Yeah, that's fair.
The one other thing is, I think in some of the language stuff, like, it, even if it's there, like, old words that we don't use anymore, that felt okay to me, because, like, you get that in medieval fantasy. Like, how many times, even in reading, like, Song of Ice and Fire, was there something we just don't know what it is? You know, part of a battlement, or, you know, different things of armor or whatever, which I don't know these words. Or, you know, there's things that were in part of their life that aren't part of ours anymore. So that part didn't really take me out of it so much. But, you know, It was in things like this when you get a really modern word. That's where it really bothered me more, I think.
I think also there's probably not a big pool of people who specialize in translating from Polish to English. Because, my roommate wants to be just considering doing Urdu translation. And I'm like, well, you should get on, like, French to Urdu or Urdu to French, because, like, that's probably more niche than, like, English to, you know, it's like, if you get, like, more niche, there's, like, it's hard to find people that are, like, not like good at their job, because obviously they're good at their job, but that are like treat it more as like an art, I guess, because like when you get like English to Polish, that's probably a lot easier because it's easier to translate into your native language than from it. And I can't imagine there's a lot of native English Polish speakers that are trying to translate Polish work into English usually. So like,
do they ever have like where they do translation where you have like a native speaker from both languages that's they're both bilingual and they kind of like work together to do that? Or I mean,
to be honest, I don't know how it works. Like, I know at least like in Canada, like my school, my university, like it's a major that you can have, which is like French to English translation or English to French translation. I think it's a back and forth, but that's also because I live in Montreal, so like you're gonna get a bajillion bilingual people. Whereas like if you have a language like Polish, like there is a ton of Polish people and a ton of like Polish expat Polish people, or like Polish diaspora or whatever the word is. But like, I just, can you think of like any other Polish work that has come to be in English? You know, it's just like I can't imagine
that has this level of,
at least that right.
Like, yeah. Right. That's well, not like a scientific journal or something, you know, something that's like, can be more clinical.
So the problem with translations is often, and this gets worse. This problem gets worse the more niche the language is. Usually translation usually just one person works on it. Right. You don't do it with somebody else.
Maybe they should.
Maybe, well, but usually
I think publishers if you try to
ask more people. Way more expensive, way more time consuming. Exactly. Like.
Publishers don't have enough money as it is. But so what usually happens is they get reviewed. And hopefully one of the people reviewing their translation, somebody who is familiar with the original language. But of course, the problem still would still be is would the reviewer be willing to then check the translations side by side?
Right. That's going to take a lot.
That's going to take a lot. Yeah.
Right. So one thing to just read it. Another thing to like read both of them at the same time. That's
so the prose is probably edited for English, but not for.
If you put two people that. Like two bilingual people in a room and ask them to translate something together, it will never end. No. Like that's just
a great point.
Like language brains just
translations.
Yeah. Oh my god! The amount of
at some point someone has to make the calls. Yeah, you can't.
Yeah, the amount of judgment arguments that we get into at my apartment because two of us are linguistics majors.
Yeah,
is just
And you also have to consider that your translation should be trying to keep the same tone and the same feeling of the original. And that's also going to be hard because like a literal translation may not capture, you know, in English what he's trying to say in Polish or vice versa. Exactly. You know? So that's got to be.
Yeah. And it's one of those things that like whenever I watch someone translating like certain languages, like during a speech or something, and you can tell that it's fairly simple, like certain languages coming to English and other languages like. I was watching their like, you know, everyone's doing like Comic-Con at home because of the the pandemic and stuff. And so there was like a Japanese panel with a bunch of like people that make these products. And like the girl doing the English translation, you could tell there's so many times when she's just like how do I say this? You know, right. Just like trying to do it as quickly as possible.
And gets and behind.
Like, mad props. Like, yeah, like, you know, it's I can't very even hard fathom to do.
How you do that, how you keep what someone just said in your head and then translate it. Like, I can't.
Yeah. Especially if there's no equivalent. You have to very quickly come up with something.
I looked into sign language interpretation for a bit. Like, I was actually supposed to do some of that, some sign language interpretation before coronavirus, but then coronavirus happened. And it's just like, it's so hard because you have to like basically be in real time. And then if you don't know the word, it's like, well, I'll make it sound as close. Like, I'll make up a word basically is, or like my roommate's girlfriend studies Irish and she's like, everything in Ireland has to be in Irish. Like, and so they just make up words because they don't have a word in Irish for like, whatever, because nobody actually is talking about like health things in Irish in Ireland. They just make up words. Like they're like, this one sounds okay.
Well, that's the history of language. If you look at almost every single language, there's so many words that are borrowed from other languages.
Right. I remember when I was my first time I went to Japan when I had our group had a little, we had a group tour and they had a little like book of, you know, they had a little book that was the guide. And one of the things was a page or two, like three pages of like, you know, just common words you might need to look up. And I remember my favorite was the word for laptop was rapatoppa. I just remember that was funny. I was like, obviously this is not a Japanese word.
Yeah,
there's tons of those words. Japan,
in English we have them too.
Japanese has a separate alphabet just for words that are borrowed from foreign languages.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, get that Romaji in there.
Two separate languages alphabets. Katakana
is just normal for like non-kanji words, but is it Romani or Romanji?
Romanji, yeah.
Yeah, is for the incorporated words. Yeah, it's a fun time.
Well, I didn't expect to be so educated today.
I know, right? This
is awesome.
I mean, I took a whole course on Indo-European like language evolution, so I can talk about this for days.
Yeah. Although at some point I think we're going to lose our listeners. So
yeah, that's true.
I feel like they want to listen to this more than The Witcher, to be honest.
Maybe.
Yeah, guys, you know, if you're bored, you can hit that like speed ahead 30 seconds thing until you find something you like. You know, come on.
Yeah. Or by that, you mean I'm just going to put most of this at the end. So
to have an add timestamps, just be like, okay, like this is where we're talking about this thing.
I used to do timestamps. It's a lot of work.
Yeah, I was kidding.
I usually do just for chapters, you know.
Okay, we're not gonna get into an editing discussion.
Right.
I'm making that executive call.
podcast.
I guess.
Yeah.
This book's called Blood of Elves. That sounds cooler.
Funny side note, we're talking about squirrels here. Yesterday I woke up to hearing a noise in my bedroom and there was a squirrel sitting on top of my air conditioner. And I'm like, oh my God, he apparently ate through, you know, that like, you know how you put like foam around to keep the air out. Well, he ate through it and was actually starting to make a nest in my apartment in the corner of my bedroom. I found like leaves and he actually ate through half of my drapes and all that and made a nice little nest in the corner. So nice. I'm now freaked out whenever
to give him that space, David. Like
I know, right?
He took it by rights.
Well, it was funny actually.
Yes, squatter's rights.
He luckily ran out of the apartment. I was afraid he'd be like running around and lost and I'd have to be like, oh my God. But he ran out the window and then he sat on like, I have a fire escape and he sat on the fire escape looking at me like, what are you doing in my nest? Then he, like, I banged the window and the air conditioner.
You evicted him during a pandemic, man.
I know, right? Right? And then he ran back. Well, the funny thing is, like, I'm now trying to figure out what am I going to do to block this because I'm realizing there's a huge hole because he ate, like, all of the foam. And so I'm like, what am I going to do? And I found some wood I had, like, for something else. And I'm putting it up. And he comes back with, like, leaves and a branch to, like, for his nest, looking at me like, hey, what are you doing? Why are you blocking my way? It's just a bizarre note that just when I'm thinking of squirrels made me like, now I'm going to be like, every time I read this chapter, I'm going to have like nightmare flashbacks of being woken up by a squirrel. Demon squirrel.
Thinking of how German people can't pronounce squirrel in English the whole time.
Well, that's I can't pronounce the Choyatel or whatever it is. Yeah. So I just think of them as the squirrels, which maybe I should now.
This book's called Blood of Elves. That sounds cooler.